Welcome to the Treasury Talent Podcast, the show which brings together the Treasury community to share valuable insights, top-level knowledge, and inspire diversity. Here's your host, Simon Lynch.
We're getting a lot of calls now from folks that are don't have us as a solution yet, and they're absolutely scrambling to because they don't have visibility to what those exposures are, but they're seeing in the results a lot of fires that they need to put out. So things that used to be below their thresholds and didn't give them much pain, kind of going back to what I was talking about earlier, it's both the FX volatility and the forecast volatility. So now, you know, the balance sheet is just moving like crazy. The rates that impact that are moving like crazy. And when they had a threshold above a certain amount that they'd have to investigate, they'd have one or two things in the past, and now they got 30 or 40 things to look at. It's just exploding on them.
Hello, and welcome to the Treasury Talent Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Lynch. Today, I'm joined on the program by Scott Bilter, who is the principal and owner at Atlas Risk Advisory. The reason I got Scott on is he wrote a really good article that caught my eye, which was how effective is your FX hedging program? Obviously, with the economic crisis that we're in now, I've been saying for a while that I think FX and risk and rates and all the rest of it are going up and down with wild volatility. So I thought it was a good time to have someone on that could tell us a little bit more and shed some light. I actually got all of my team to read it because it's a really good, insightful article that teaches me lots. So I hope you enjoy today's special around FX with Scott Bilter. Welcome to the program, Scott. It's great to have you.
Oh, thank you, Simon. Great to be here. Appreciate it.
I always like to ask people, how did you come to Treasury and what made you choose Treasury as your career?
Yeah, well, I think I started off as sort of your typical finance MBA with, you know, spreadsheet skills, good with numbers and all that. Started off as a financial analyst and just quickly discovered that a lot of what I was doing seemed like garbage in, garbage out analysis. Stuff that just wasn't as reality-based, seemed to be, you know, more hope-based. And so for me, it was an opportunity to kind of differentiate my skill set. You know, I've always been fascinated with the markets. So I think in terms of just differentiating yourself as a finance guy, I think that's, you know, pretty similar to a lot of folks. What brings them into Treasury, that was appealing to me. And so once I made that move after probably less than 2 years as just a financial analyst at a business unit, it's been Treasury ever since. So that definitely was in my mind early on. I just didn't get that role at first. But once I moved over, I haven't gone back.
Well, not many people leave, do they? Once you're bitten by the Treasury bug, you're there for a while.
Yep.
And so you started off life in the corporate sense, 7 years with HP, five of those within the FX space. You then moved across to the banking side and spent 3 years with Merrill Lynch on the FX sales side. And then you went back to HP, what is a great breeding ground for Treasury folks, for another 5 years. Again, a lot in the FX and some corporate finance. And then you did a little stint running the FP&A team for a while there before you left to set up Atlas FX, which you set up 9 years ago. So I guess, firstly, tell us a little bit about Atlas FX because it's probably a little different to what most listeners would think.
Yeah, so we're a SaaS company, so software as a service, kind of subscription model where we lead with, you know, we've got a technology that helps people get an understanding of what their exposures are to start with. So kind of solve the problem of, ERPs like SAP and Oracle are really designed for seeing your information in US dollar terms, and they're really not designed. They don't have out-of-the-box reports that help from an FX risk management standpoint. So kind of the first thing we do is we know how to get that information out of there, organize it, and kind of play it back to a customer because, you know, if you try to get that report yourselves, you may have millions of lines of data, not what overwhelm Excel. So we kind of get the exposures. We know how to take that whole process through the whole hedging workflow. So we work with producing the exposures, your trades, sending it to an execution platform, bringing that back and giving you the analysis of how well you've done, both for cash flow and balance sheet hedging, help with the accounting on the back end. So really the whole life cycle from end to end. And we're really big on automating anything that's manual and optimizing the whole process. So wherever we see inefficiencies, unnecessary expense, unnecessary volatility, we really try to stamp that out. So it's kind of a consulting add-on to the technology. So we really, you know, work long-term with our customers, folks we've had for years. We still have, you know, maybe monthly meetings or biweekly meetings just to make sure that we understand their upcoming challenges and continue to work through that with them.
So just going back to from a career perspective, you're predominantly a corporate guy early on in your career, but you spent 3 years with Merrill's. How would you contrast the corporate treasury side to working on the banking FX sales side?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a bit different. They're definitely different cultures. And with, you know, a little less than 3 years at Merrill Lynch, I can't say to have, you know, the complete experience of the banking side, but it was a little bit more of maybe what's stereotypical of a bit of the everyone for themselves mentality. I wasn't as keen on what I saw with too much time spent kind of fighting over the share of the pie, or even, you know, management trying to deal with that for the individuals that were always, you know, fighting over that kind of stuff. So I think you just have a different type of person that's often attracted to the bank environment. And I don't want to completely stereotype it, because I know some folks that have had, you know, great careers on the banking side and do some really great stuff on the advisory side and really love that problem solving aspect of their jobs. So you know, certainly not an all or nothing thing, but that was a little bit more of that on the banking side, not as much collaboration. And for me, just the role I had wasn't as much of the problem solving and the consulting as I would have liked. A little bit more of just, you know, the sales thing, which I'm not, you know, I kind of got the sales thing out of my system. That's not my primary thing. So I think I just enjoyed the culture of the corporate side a little bit more than the banking side for me.
What about comparing that corporate treasury side to the advisory work that you're doing now?
You know, there's more complexities for sure with the advising side now, because we're seeing a lot of different business models. It did help having all that time at Hewlett Packard, because, you know, HP, especially back then, you know, a decade or two ago, it's a very complex company, really kind of like a tech holding company. Even beyond that, there's medical devices and other parts. So there was a lot of challenges, and it was not a one size fits all. From a hedging standpoint, we had a lot of different business models that needed different approaches and different solutions. So a lot of what we built there internally and then what we then brought to the market with Alice FX was something that was really based on flexibility. So that's been really good, because now that we've talking to other companies and other industries, we've seen, you know, different environments, different, there's lots of different choices companies can make that all affect their FX exposures and the ways you need to hedge them. So, you know, I think there's more to go through on the advisory side now that we talk to even more companies. So that's been very rewarding.
And when you were making that move, going from corporate into banking and then back to corporate, and then obviously starting up your own business, was it challenging to make those moves across the different industries?
Yeah, I mean, I think we had the typical challenges of a startup for sure, where everyone does a bit of everything. And we have, you know, three partners that started the firm. And we had a lot of, you know, FX risk management domain expertise and technology expertise, but other things, you know, weren't necessarily our core strengths, like the sales and marketing. And, you know, everyone's got to learn some little bits of different jobs as they go. And somehow I became the legal expert. And, you know, my dad was a lawyer, but I don't know how much of that rubbed off on me. So, you know, lots of challenges in that way that are kind of typical of a startup. But certainly, yeah, the culture I talked about of going from the corporate side to the banking side and back again, you know, lots of changes there. And it's good to really, you know, kind of push the envelope and see what works for you and what doesn't. Even if something, you know, ends up being, you know, not the best fit, usually you can learn from that and apply it to, you know, decisions you make down the road. So I think it's all been good, but it has been a challenge.
Now, the reason we're chatting is you wrote an article, an excellent article that caught my eye, actually, around FX hedging, which really related to this highly volatile market that we're in. First of all, maybe start off telling me the distinction between cash flow and balance sheet hedging? Because I wasn't aware of this before I read your article.
Yeah, so cash flow hedging, and it is a bit confusing because it's kind of a misnomer from the Financial Accounting Standards Board from way back when, or the FASB, when they called it cash flow hedging. Because a lot of people really, when they're executing that, they're doing an income statement hedge and hedging to a revenue date or an expense date. So that's just sort of a longer term economic hedge that, you know, you might be able to somehow make adjustments with some pricing or ways of mitigating that. But it's sort of your long term exposure that you're looking to cover. And that could be, you know, 3, 6, 12 months, 18 months. It could be fairly far out that you may do the cash flow hedging and maybe layer that in over time is fairly typical. And balance sheet hedging is a little bit more mechanical and more common across companies in terms of just every month you're kind of protecting your balance sheet from remeasurement from one month to the next. There's some differences if you have a different accounting rate methodology, the way you go about it is a little bit different. But in general, you know, it's the same idea, and there's no real reason to not hedge, you know, 100% of your main exposures there versus the cash flow side where some, you know, a lower percentage often is the case. So different things where they appear on your results as well. So cash flow hedging is often allocated to the businesses or the geographies. Balance sheet hedging is usually just kept at corporate, or at least the business folks don't have much of a say or an interest in the results there. That goes to other income and expense. So a different line on the P&L wouldn't get allocated to, you know, the profit or the revenue or the expense or other options you may have for cash flow hedging.
Scott, why do you think FX and financial markets are so baffling for folks?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with there's often, you know, rotational jobs in foreign exchange and treasury. And so it's tough to build that expertise. And there's a lot of treasury groups that are awfully lean, especially the FX group. It could be, you know, a fraction of one person's job at a small or a medium-sized company. So pretty tough to get that expertise, especially if you're, you know, maybe doing some two-year stint and maybe you don't catch the treasury bug and you move on to something else. So for folks that are not career treasury people and they're all of a sudden tasked with pretty big responsibility of mitigating that risk, it's a tough thing to do. And their entire career might be during a really quiet time like we had up until about 3 or 4 months ago. And you only do some things maybe once a month or maybe once a quarter. So it does take a while to get expertise. And you know, with that, since it's just such a small part of a lot of people's job, they often just kind of punt on it. Or, you know, if it's trying to get businesses engaged in it, it's just complex enough that they typically don't want to. And they kind of stick with the status quo because they don't want to go out there and make a change and then get blamed for it. So, you know, the corporate culture is a little bit different than maybe the banking side where you can get rewarded for risk taking. Treasury folks are usually quite risk averse. So to put yourself out there and make a change, and if it backfires on you, you know, you can still get fired, but you don't really have the upside. So you see a lot of that.
And do you think that's why corporate FX strategies tend to be reactive rather than proactive?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it takes conviction to be proactive. So again, not, you know, risk averse folks probably not really thinking it's the best move unless they're really quite sure that something is going wrong. And that is more probably on the cash flow side too. So the balance sheet side, unless you know, there's some obvious things and huge problems. That's more kind of mechanical month to month. In terms of changing strategies without you know, kind of the upside reward of getting it right, it's a trickier thing to do for folks.
And obviously, the coronavirus and the volatility that we've got currently has blown things up dramatically. Does that mean that a lot of the previous FX strategies are not so effective?
Yeah, it certainly can. And it makes me think of the Warren Buffett quote of, you don't know who's been swimming naked until the tide goes out, or something to that effect. That's definitely been happening the last few months. And like I said, if someone's just been in this job for the last 2 or 3 years with very low FX volatility, they might not even be aware that they've got an ineffective program. hedges that were exposures that weren't hedged, that were kind of small enough, or they thought were small enough, they had a pretty low impact. And now all of a sudden, some things are quite large. So you can have a combination of maybe some pricing assumptions, or the amount of time that you need to buy is different in the past than what it might be now. It seems like the markets are really accelerating things. So stuff that would happen over quarters or years are now happening in days or weeks now. So it's definitely a different environment. And really that combination of increased currency volatility and forecast deviations that are really going through the roof right now, I mean, that's kind of the math behind what's potentially your ineffectiveness of a hedging program. So that sort of double hit is really exposing basically who's been swimming naked. Since those have both exploded.
And you mentioned earlier, sometimes this is just a part of someone's role. How does resourcing make effective? How is it relevant to being effective in your FX risk management?
Yeah, well, I guess because of that, sort of that SAS model, it's very relevant. And just the idea of applying scale versus trying to build something that works really well one company at a time, that's really hard. It's tough to do, and you have to have that kind of intersection of domain expertise and technology expertise to make it work. And finance people don't always speak technology very well, and vice versa. So kind of working with your own IT group for building solutions is just not the easiest thing to do. It ends up being kind of expensive long term, even if you do it just to support something internally. So for example, HP, that we had built something years ago, and when we left, they were still using that for a while. They're now a customer of ours. So even just maintaining something internally that was working can be pretty expensive. I think it's very relevant for a lot of models, but certainly for treasury, where you have just a few people typically in an FX group that are, tasked with this. And when they move on, there's a lot of risk that could go out the door with someone in particular that's got a lot of domain expertise.
Now, with hedging, I've often been told that accounting can be the tail wagging the dog. What do people mean by that?
Well, what I meant by that when I was writing about that in the paper is just my kind of going back to my experience at HP and dealing with auditors, where in some cases, we'd have this young rookie auditor that just knew something from their previous engagement and thought that that's how it should be done everywhere. And I kind of had to talk him down and say, well, that's one way of doing it. It's not the way we're doing it. And I think I haven't seen as much pushback as I would like to see when I talk to customers and prospects and how they interact with their auditors. And it seems to be, the auditor says jump and they say how high. And there's a lot of subjectivity to a lot of the rules. And if you start off with, okay, this is what accounting wants, and let's work backwards from there, I don't think that's a great way of doing it. You need to think about, all right, what is the best solution for my company? And how do I, interpret the accounting rules to make that work? Because there usually is a valid interpretation of the rules to make it work. So that's more of what I meant by not letting the accounting tail wag the dog when it comes to FX.
I've heard that plenty of times, though. Like that, the rules in that area are mostly gray rather than black and white. So if you try and play black and white, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And you talk about business partnering being really important for FX risk management. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that just kind of goes to, and this is probably more on the cash flow hedging side again, but understanding the underlying exposures. If you don't really understand them, it's going to be tough to properly hedge them. So a lot of this is, again, where a layered approach might make sense, but there is no one-size-fits-all for different companies, or maybe even different parts of the business within the company, as I was kind of describing with, Hewlett Packard. There's with HP, a leasing business or a services business where there's multi-year contracts. Those are some firm commitments you can hedge for a longer period of time, and it makes sense. You could have other things where, if it's a personal computer that you're going to be selling a different version of in 6 months, you don't have a sticky long-term FX risk there. You can just introduce it at a new local currency price point down the road. So definitely not one size fits all. There could be, some currency sharing clauses with suppliers. There could be some dynamics with your procurement or your competition. If you're selling some into a market where there's local competition, that's a lot different than if you're selling in, you know, a different market where they don't have competition there, and that might be more dollar-based type of pricing. So there's just a lot of different dynamics to understand with the business, and those can change over time. So you really need to partner to understand what your exposures are, and, you know, can they be mitigated with some price changes? What makes sense in terms of percentage that you should hedge, and how far out should you hedge? So without really being plugged in to the businesses and understanding what their metrics are, because someone at the company has, well, hopefully many people have some dollar-based results that they're held to. So you really need to understand how to bridge that gap with hedging and explain it to folks.
Now, something I hadn't thought about, Scott, as a layperson, was the sales team's budgeted FX or their planned FX rates and how important they are in the process.
Yeah, and this is another one of those things that sometimes, most companies will have a kind of once a year planning process where you have to kind of draw a line in the sand at what the market is, what the rates are a month or two before the fiscal year starts, for example, and say, okay, for the planning process, use this rate for euro, use this rate for yen, et cetera. And that's fine, but is that then the thing that everyone's held to, or does that change over time? Part of what, and you referenced my time at FP&A at HP, we did a good job at HP of kind of bridging that gap and working with FP&A. We had that same once a year process, but that actually got overridden with this quarterly flash process that really ended up being what where folks' feet were held to the fire in terms of their deliverables. And with that, we rolled in some different hedge rates over time. So I think folks would just say, okay, here's the rate to use for the whole year. That doesn't really work with a layered hedging approach, and you need to kind of bridge that gap and at least show where those differences appear with your hedge rate, so you can kind of show the rate differences, the volume differences, and understanding how to get people back to, you know, a metric that makes sense. Or the beginning of that period when you're setting that budget rate, have it be kind of a weighted average of what you've already hedged and your best guess of what you would hedge going forward. So at least you're starting off at something that's achievable or has already been partially achieved with your hedging. So the main thing is that if your metrics are way off and you have someone that, you know, maybe they only have a local currency quota, and, you know, if the currency devalues, they meet their numbers, but in U.S. dollar terms, you know, you miss by a mile. So that's not great for the company. You just want to have metrics lined up well enough that someone either doesn't have a huge tailwind that makes their goal very easy, or a huge headwind that makes it so they give up and maybe punt business to the next year because they know they're not going to get paid much the current year. It really is just about, you know, metrics driving behavior and foreign exchange risk management helping in that process, and not being sort of this mysterious, you know, other impact that's messing up the numbers.
Scott, you talk about an effective hedge needs some stress testing. Coronavirus has probably been one of the best tests out there. What have you seen from your clients recently?
Yeah, I think, well, definitely an emphasis on maybe increasing the cadence of forecasting, you know, acknowledging that a stale forecast could be pretty bad pretty quickly. And maybe looking at some stuff that if you thought that it was unhedged previously, I mean, thankfully our customers have, they can see all that data, and even the stuff that's not hedged, they see what those exposures are. So you're not scrambling. We're seeing, I'd say I'm seeing different things from our customers and our prospects. We're getting a lot of calls now from folks that are, that, you know, don't have us as a solution yet, and they're absolutely scrambling to, because they don't have visibility to what those exposures are, but they're seeing in the results a lot of fires that they need to put out. So things that used to be below their thresholds and didn't give them much pain, kind of going back to what I was talking about earlier, it's both the FX volatility and the forecast volatility. So now, you know, the balance sheet is just moving like crazy. The rates that impact that are moving like crazy. And when they had a threshold above a certain amount that they'd have to investigate, they'd have one or two things in the past, and now they got 30 or 40 things to look at. It's just exploding on them. So Yeah, it's a, looking at what was sort of below the threshold, and especially emerging market currencies where there's been a lot of volatility has come to the fore. And then where you can just, more forecasting, get the latest and greatest forecast and make adjustments quickly.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I've often said a CFO doesn't know the value of treasury until something blows up, and it's certainly blown up recently.
Yeah. We've talked about a lot of FX policies are kind of written in blood, unfortunately. The waiting for a big problem to happen and then adjusting things isn't ideal, but that's a lot of what's going on out there, I'm afraid.
Absolutely. And as such, you talk about being the sucker at the poker table from an FX perspective. Tell listeners, what do you mean by that currently?
Yeah, I think that was more on the trading side, about making sure that you're going into an FX trade. Again, this is where you might have someone that's new to a role coming in, and all of a sudden they're tasked with trading millions and tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars with banks, and hopefully they've got information right in front of them. But the banks will absolutely make, they always have made the majority of their money on the minority of customers that have the least information. So you just don't want to be that person. So you got to have live prices in front of you. If you're an organization that doesn't have a Bloomberg terminal, there's still lots of other free ways to get live prices in front of you. And then, definitely bidding things out to multiple counterparties. So if you're small enough that you've just been trading with, one bank and using them exclusively, you're most likely getting ripped off. So you got to bid things out, ideally not even showing the side of your trade. There's lots of ways, and we've talked to a lot of folks about reducing their trading costs in a number of ways, the more sophisticated programs do a much better job of this, and the dollars really do add up. So if you think that you don't know, you're probably getting taken.
Wise words. Anything else, from an FX tips perspective that you would offer to listeners?
I think it'll be interesting part of what's happening now, and if you think of what happened back in 2008, 2009, there's going to be some problems in the banking system for sure. There's some banks that a lot of people have been worried about for years, and now it's going to come to the fore pretty quickly. So I think in terms of dealing with that, a lot of folks don't have a great read on their counterparty risk. We work with our customers about showing that and a better, just want to look at credit ratings. Lehman Brothers went, I think, from single A to bankrupt over the weekend. So that was too late of a signal. So you don't want to wait for Moody's and Fitch and others to tell you what the problem is. So there's some real-time monitoring that you can do in that regard, but there's also I think going to be a movement of maybe moving things and moving more trading to an exchange. Certainly a lot of the credit spreads have gone much higher for customers, especially on the cash flow hedging if they're going further out, and they're probably seeing that and paying a lot for that. So there is the ability to trade FX over an exchange, and then mostly it's, people just aren't aware of that, because over-the-counter gives you the flexibility to the exact amount and the exact date that you want. But if you're able to take some of that risk off and just do it to the monthly futures maturity date and not have any credit risk and then not pay for the credit risk that the bank is taking with you, that could be a much better solution. So that's something that we've talked with people about in the past, but usually you need kind of a shock like this. And I think that's going to be something in the future that is, in just months away that more people are going to be looking at. So happy to have those conversations with folks, because I think it's going to be a pretty big deal.
It's going to be a big deal for sure. And just talking more generally then, Scott, what's your advice for listeners around networking, and how have you approached that over your career?
I think it. I do really like LinkedIn. That's been a great. It's the only real social networking thing I've ever used, because it's, I guess, what people think of the more adult one, and the more useful one from a business perspective, and that has been very useful in terms of keeping track of people. That often gets used when people are looking for jobs, and that's a great thing to have to see the connections. being in our position, we're not, you know, like you, the direct recruiters, but we are kind of the informal recruiters a lot of the times. So we do hear about, you know, openings in that regard, and like to see folks that we know are really good and talented people land in good situations. So, you know, I think being active on LinkedIn and just just asking questions from of people and taking advantage of offers. So a lot of times we'll talk to people, we'll find out, you know, maybe it's not a great fit right now for our services, but maybe they're too small, maybe they're growing, but I know that they're going to have some growing pains along the way, and I say, hey, just give me a call. You know, if you have any questions about this stuff, it doesn't matter that, you know, we're not you're not a client right now. Just give me a call and just talk it out. And, you know, some people take advantage of that, some don't. So I'd say if you ever get those offers, absolutely, you know, take people up on it.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you're fortunate that you come out of HP, which is a really great grounding. And, you know, there's countless people out there that are in very senior treasury roles now that are part of your network, which is very fortunate.
Yeah, no, that was pretty helpful in us starting our business as well, having that kind of expanded XHP folks all over the valley here had, you know, led to at least a lot of good calls early on. So that network was very important. So yeah, it does help. It has definitely been a breeding ground for treasury groups. Like HP's treasury group was enormous many years ago compared to what we see for a lot of companies today. So they're very, very lean and mean. So yeah, take advantage of any networking that you can. And if there's a kind of a group treasury management association or some group, you know, peer groups, which obviously aren't meeting these days, but maybe online. But, you know, once those do come back, those are pretty useful for folks to share information and collaborate, get an idea of what's working out there and what's not.
And Scott, if you could go back to, you know, your early career and for those that are, you know, just starting out, what's the best piece of advice you wish you'd been told?
I think, you know, don't just, and I think maybe in my first couple of years, even before joining Treasury, just sort of the first corporate role, and just assuming that, you know, the things that were happening made sense and that there was a reason for them. I would say, feel free to challenge that right off the bat. Don't think that just because it's done a certain way, that it makes sense to do it that way. That applies outside of Treasury as well, but it absolutely applies to Treasury and foreign exchange and, you know, different strategies or different processes that are in place. You know, something might have been there for reasons that are really, really old, and they may no longer apply for a number of reasons. And so if you think that something seems a little odd, trust your instincts and question and say, why do we do this? And if you don't get a very good answer, you know, ask a different way or a different person. But I would trust your instincts that something is wrong if you get that feeling, and keep pushing it.
And when you're hiring, Scott, what are the things that you tend to focus on in getting good people into your team?
I mean, it sometimes depends on the role, but I would say, you know, for us, technology expertise is really big. You know, having energy and work ethic is obviously really important. So we try to think about, you know, someone that we'd be comfortable putting in front of a client, because we're all, you know, very hands-on with our customers. So, you know, somewhat role specific. It's not so much, you know, they have to be a subject matter expert. We can train them on that. So we have some excellent folks that came in with absolutely no FX experience, but, you know, they had other skills that really have worked well in getting them where they are today.
Now, Scott, you obviously deal with a lot of treasurers in your business. What would you say makes a successful treasurer in the eyes of the CFO, the CEO, the board?
Well, ideally, if you're able to anticipate problems before they happen, that's probably about the best thing you can do for the, you know, for that group of people. And not being afraid to give bad or unpopular news, I think, is important. There's danger in having a herd mentality in a lot of areas, but it really is dangerous in finance. You know, I think of, there's probably been less of that before this particular crisis, but certainly before the financial crisis, 2008, 2009, there was a lot of people just searching for yield and not thinking about the risk. And it was almost, you know, they talk about risk-free return. It was really return-free risk. And that's, I think, what we've had the last couple of years. And it's just the, you know, the worst timing of being, you know, looking for yield at the end of a business cycle right before things are crashing. So I think since then, a lot more groups have stayed pretty conservative, but, you know, being able to anticipate problems, and even though the coronavirus wasn't as easily anticipated, there's been some cracks in the financial system, you know, starting with the repo market going crazy last September that have, you know, signaling a lot of things about an end of a long boom that we've had here that should have been on Treasurer's radar. So I think, you know, not being afraid to give unpopular news, other areas that, you know, treasurers could be involved in, you know, share repurchase and things like that. Typically, companies are buying way too much at the top. I was involved years ago about trying to talk HP down about how much we should be buying at a certain time. And, you know, folks at the board and CFO thought I was being a little bit too conservative, and then turned out to be correct. And they appreciated that later and listened a little bit more later. So you may not always get through the first time, but if you know, if you have a reason for it and you kind of gain the respect of those folks, then they'll listen more the next time.
And just one final question for you, Scott. How do you see the role of the treasurer changing in the next few years, particularly with technology advancements?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of it could be changing with what's happening with the banking side. There was certainly, you know, so a lot of it has to do with the relationships, and obviously these credit revolvers are being tapped today, you know, very frequently, and people are getting the max that they can out of them. And then the pricing of the new revolvers is going to reflect that. It's going to be much more expensive. So I think the whole kind of loss leader model of the credit revolver might be changing. It changed briefly after the 2008-2009 crisis and kind of went back to the same old. I'm not sure if it's going to permanently change or not this time. So I think, you know, getting ahead of that and understanding the relationship with banks and where it makes sense to, you know, basically to try to optimize that is important. From a technology standpoint, I think there's certainly going to be more pressure on budgets for sure. There's going to be more rationalization of vendors. So I think looking to folks that can, you know, replace maybe a few vendors and have one strat, you know, one group that can do it all is going to be more and more common versus, you know, maybe the paying the most expensive of everything out there is, you know, where a lot of folks are today. And maybe that's not the best thing to do going forward. So I think that's probably where, you know, the technology trends are going to go, more consolidation as fewer folks are going to survive in the next several years, I think.
Absolutely. Well, Scott, thank you very much, firstly, for a great article that taught me a lot about FX. And secondly, thank you very much for coming on the program. It's been really enjoyable chatting to you.
Yeah, no, very much appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Treasury Talent Podcast. Remember, subscribe, refer your friends, and leave us a review. We're keen to keep this thing living on iTunes. I hope you liked it, but if you've got any information you'd like to pass on, any questions, please just shoot me an email, simon@treasurytalent.com.